Hey, Mike, before we kick off today's episode, I just want to remind all of our listeners out there, if you haven't had a chance to do so yet, make sure you check out our new Facebook group. Very easy to find. Just go on Facebook, search The Golf Podcast under groups. You'll see it pop up. It's completely free to join, and it's an excellent way to carry the conversation on between episodes. I mean, we've really got a lot in there where guys are able to ask some questions. We're talking a little bit more. We're sharing some instructional articles, everything. You know, it's a great way to link up with other listeners. We have listeners from all over the globe. So it's really becoming a fun place to just kind of share ideas, share goals, share accomplishments on the course. And I'm enjoying it. So I'm hoping we can keep growing that group.
Yeah, listen, we all need a platform to brag, complain, share photos of that bucket list round or whatever the case may be. I mean, this is what the group's all about. It's like-minded golfers all looking to improve, all looking to kind of share their stories, just like you said. I love the group, Frank. I love posting, you know, successes about a round or failures and just asking questions. It's like the best golf advice we can get out there, you know?
Yeah, and we fired it up on Facebook because, you know, we're all there anyway. So right. It's a great place and it's a great way to interact with other fans of the show. So like I said, on Facebook, just search The Golf Podcast. You can join the group 100% free, and we'll see you in there. All right, Mike, on to the show.
Welcome to the Golf Podcast, presented by Golficity, where we bring you the tips, instruction, and support you need to get the most out of your golf game. And now your hosts, Frank and Mike.
Hey, welcome back to the Golf Podcast. This is episode number 133. We're going to mix it up tonight, Mike. We're going to talk a little bit off topic. We're not going to quite go into too much instruction, although I'm sure, as always, we'll wrap into that in one way or another. But we're going to do our What's in the Bag?
I love it.
episode. And this is something that actually it comes from a lot of our listener requests out there. People asking us, you know, what equipment we play. But more importantly, because I know the reason why everyone wants to know, you know, the what's in the bag for this year's Masters champ, because they want to emulate it. Well, Mike and I don't think anybody's buying clubs just because we're doing something with them. More so, what we want to talk about is what led us to choose the clubs we're playing. So we talk about, there's a lot of strategy, a lot of thought that goes into that. So our hope tonight is, by discovering that and diving into that, you know, our listeners out there can kind of rethink and maybe put a new, shed some new light on their own equipment and the reasons why they pick things. And, you know, we want to hear from you too. Make sure you share it. Share it in our Facebook group. You know, you can email us at podcast@golficity.com, tweet us at Golficity. Let us know. I mean, again, this is something we want to hear what you're playing just as much as you want to hear what we're playing. So we'll definitely talk about that. Couple things before we, get started here tonight, Mike. One interesting thing that we had come in, and this is actually kind of funny. It's a rules thing. You know, we touch on this every once in a while. We touch on those, the rules and the, how it can get a little bit hairy and questionable out there. So had a situation, actually a buddy of mine who was playing around last weekend. Mm-hmm. He called me up to tell me about this, and I'll admit I had some ideas of what the answer might be, but wasn't 100% sure. So I reached out to Richard Todd, author of The Golf Rules, and he's kind of our unofficial rules guy. He's a
guru.
Listener of the show, and you know, we always tell him when we don't know, we pass it right on to him, because he always comes back to me with such a great, quick, concise answer. So I'm going to tell you the situation, Mike. Tell me what you think was the ruling here. So he's playing, it's the 17th hole. The right side of the course there has a fence, and the fence is clearly defining like the edge of the course, so to speak. Okay. On the other side of the fence, there's some trees, you know, a little bit or whatever it might be, some brush. And then there's eventually a road. So it's just kind of
obvious,
like,
OB.
Well, you know, it's...
Well, okay, that's what we're getting to.
Well, here's the interesting thing, because this is a question I asked him. I said, where are the OB stakes? Is it OB? How's it marked? And interestingly enough, he said that he didn't see any white stakes. He had the same thinking. He said, it's most likely out of bounds. I mean, it's off the golf course. By definition, it has to be. Now, my thinking would also be that somewhere on the scorecard it should say, but we'll get into that in a second. But here's what happens. He ends up with the ball very, very close to the fence where he can't put a swing on it. He can't. So he asks the guy he's playing against, and he says, look, you know, who happened to also be his friend. This was a friendly competition, right? And he asks him, can I get a free relief from this because it's man-made? It's a man-made structure. So okay. The guy tells him, no. He wouldn't let him have it, right? So I said, well, there's your bigger issue. Your friend is...
You need a new friend.
Yeah, you need a new friend. Right. So he said his friend would not let him take relief from it. So he ends up making triple bogey because he had to just kind of slap at it until he moved it further away. Now, what I had also told him was that at the worst case, he could have then probably taken an unplayable, right? And then not having to just kind of slap at the ball because he couldn't put a swing on it. But I want to know, what's your interpretation? What do you think? What would you have done in that situation?
Well, where's the ball again? Is it on the fence or on the other side?
It's inside the fence. It's not on the other side of the fence. He didn't have to cross the fence. It's inside the fence, but
it's just tucked against it.
It's so tucked against it that he really can't swing a golf club without hitting the fence.
Ooh, that's a tough one. Okay, if I'm the playing partner, I instantly say just kick it out. Playing for money or not. I mean,
you're just trying to give the guy a break.
Because immediately I'm thinking kind of the same, you know, man-made structure. If it was not there, then you would have a clear shot,
yes,
most likely. So that's what I would instantly think. I'm kind of thinking there's a twist here that's telling me that you got to play that as it lies, which it could be too. So this is a tough one here.
It is a tough one. And here's the toughest part about it is we must be missing some form of information here. Okay. And I'll explain in a second. And this is where the bigger point that I want to make, and this is something that I wanted to talk about on the show because I know our listeners are going to run into this. And Richard comes up with an excellent suggestion of how to handle it. But what he says, let's start with the actual ruling. You know, if it's a fence that defines out of bounds, it's considered fixed. And there you have to either play the ball as it lies or take a one stroke penalty and take an unplayable lie. Okay.
Okay.
So if that fence was one of two things, either staked, painted, whatever, you know, with white so that we knew it was that, or, and this is what I had asked my buddy too. I'm like, look on that scorecard, because usually something like that, it'll say, you know, fence marks out of bounds on 17 or whatever. But the scorecard, he said, didn't say it. So this is where it got really tough. He said there was no clear marking whether that marked the out of bounds or not. So again, if it did mark the out of bounds, then he's got to, it's either play it as it lies or take that one stroke penalty, no relief, nothing like that. However, what Richard says is if that fence was not the out of bounds markers, it would be considered an immovable object and he would be able to take relief. So without the markings, technically there, he can take relief. Here's only one caveat to that. If it's considered an integral part of the course, very great example. The example everyone knows is that cart path on the road hole at, St. Andrews.
Right.
But that is marked. That's known, well known in advance that is an integral part. So there's no relief from that path. So here again, it all would have depended on the markings. And what my friend indicated was that he didn't see any markings. That would have made it a little bit clearer. So it's kind of undefined. It's kind of up in the air. So he had a great suggestion. And this is something that I would suggest anybody, if you get in a similar situation, because what he ended up doing is he listened to his buddy who probably, depending on the marking, was probably wrong here. He listened to his buddy and he ruined his score. So what Richard says is the best thing to do is play two balls. Okay. Play one ball as it lies, like his partner had wanted him to do. And two, the second ball, you're declaring that it's provisional, declaring that you're allowing, you know, that relief from the fence and declaring it ahead of time. He said, write both scores on the card, noting which score matches the scenario. And then when you go back in the clubhouse, ask the pro or the committee or the ruling official which one it is. And I love that idea because you know
it's
what?
Great.
Then it's best of both worlds. Okay, this is what happened, you know, but if in the chance where you go back and you say, we had the wrong ruling, at least you're not saying, man, you can't go back at that point. You can't change it. It's 17 hole, right. You know, that's it. So
that's really interesting. You know, I mean, 9 times out of 10, you know, no good golf buddy is going to say, play two balls. They're just going to say, listen, kick it out and go for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I like the idea, you know, I mean, I don't know what's going to go through your head. Now you got to play two balls, you know, pace of play, all this stuff, but
right. So he said the other thing to keep in mind, a boundary fence is out of bounds.
Right.
Because the bound, you know, the out of bounds line is drawn on the inside of the fence line. But again, I asked my friend, I asked him about three times. He said he was no line. There was nothing drawn there.
But if the fence clearly is the boundary of the course, then it
There's nothing to clearly state that because there was some brush and trees on the other side of that fence. The fence was there to keep golfers from walking into the road. But does that necessarily mean it? It should have been marked as the reality. But again, if we take anything from this and if we learn anything from it, it's that idea that you can do this. Play two balls, especially in this type of where, again, we're not talking about a very strict tournament where there's going to be a rules officials out there. If that was the case, you'd be able to call a rules official over and ask them.
Right.
But here's a situation where you don't have that. So play two, play them both all the way through, mark them on the card, and then go in and ask. And then you could figure it out from that point.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah,
really interesting.
That was an interesting one. And I wanted to share that. And thank you, Richard Todd, again, you know, for always being there for us with these rules. We really appreciate it. You know, if you want to check out and learn a little bit more about Richard, you can check out his book, The Golf Rules, on Amazon. It's really cool, really fun read because you never think the rules would be fun, you know, but the way he does it, he teaches you the rules by weaving them into these very interesting stories and situations, a lot like this one. And then he kind of decompresses later what the rules were and why that ruling was what it was. So if you're interested in that, definitely check it out. Highly recommend it. I enjoy it. So definitely check that out. Mike, I got a couple other things I want to talk about before we get into our equipment, but I know you recently played. Did you play today?
I played today, yes.
And you were mentioning to me you had something that you might have worked out in your game.
Yeah, so here's what's been happening in my golf game, especially since I got back from a long vacation. I did not play at all. You know, yes, take the violins out, but, you know, you lose the feel. You know, you don't play for a while. You really do lose it. And you know this from your back injury. You do lose that feel. It takes a while to get back in. I was going to the range a lot before I left for that trip, and I was playing a lot, you know, 2-3 times a week. So, you know, it was tough to bounce back, but I came back to a very bad slice on the drive. It just came out of nowhere. And what's funny, Frank, is every time I'd hit the ball, I'd look down at the club head of my driver, and the impact, the imprint of the ball was dead center of the club head.
Okay.
So that told me one thing. It was my swing plane. I was inside outing it, you know, to right field, or I was putting that spin on it from my swing plane. A lot of people told me that too. They said, you're not coming across the ball. You're coming inside out on the ball. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything's not in sync. Your hands are moving too, you know, far ahead of you. Your body's moving too far ahead of you. A lot of crazy things are going on. You have to figure out a way to get everything to come together at once at impact. And that was my problem.
Yeah.
Okay. So I said, well, how am I going to do that? So I went to the range the other day and I got a bucket of balls. And what it came down to, I think after the sixth or seventh shot, I just went all driver. I really wanted to figure this out. I think after the sixth or seventh one, I figured out that if I were to pause for a split second at the top of my backswing, that would allow me to bring everything together at the same time, mm-hmm. as opposed to bringing back violently and then maybe the hands are coming too quick or whatever it was. My body was coming in before my hands. Whatever the situation was that was causing it, this allowed me to do that. So not only was the ball going straight, but this was the answer to my prayers, because now I'm hitting the ball about 15 yards further off the tee. Mm-hmm. What it feels like, Frank, it feels like a rubber band. Like I'm pulling it back now and I'm holding it for a second and then I'm letting it go. So I'm getting like extra torque.
Yeah.
You know, fundamentally everything is kind of coming together just from that. It's a split pause at the very top. And today, sure enough, bombing the ball, dead center, no slice. You know, I had a couple because, you know, I did screw it up a little bit. I wasn't perfect all the time. But, hey, man, that one little, you know,
fix. So you got a Matsuyama thing going.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. They talk about that all the time. See, and he's one of the longest ball hitters on tour. But, yeah, I mean, that's just like you said, like feel is one thing that goes and timing is the other.
Right.
You know, because you're not used to playing and you can work that timing in. And a pause at the top is a good way sometimes to just kind of correct that timing, because I think where a lot of people lose their timing is that transition.
Right.
You know, a lot of times when we see where they do the slow-mo swings of the guys on tour, they talk about, look at how good and smooth his transition is. But that's a part where a lot of amateur golfers kind of lose it. And they, you know, whatever, it's maybe getting a little bit quick. And that's a place where a lot of people tend to get quick. So by doing that pause, you're just able to sync everything back up a little bit. And that's really awesome that you're able to work it out that quickly.
Yeah, and you know, a big help was, we talk about videotaping your swing. I went back to doing that, and what I noticed was, in fact, it was the hips, you know, the torso area was actually coming through the ball way before the hands. So when the hands were late, it was forcing the club head to open up significantly. So yes, I was hitting the ball dead center of the club, but you know, I was, the way that I was kind of slicing through the ball, you know, like we talked about on a recent episode, and you know, I can avert all that by just pausing for a split second. That's all it takes. And it's amazing.
Yeah. And the important lesson here is, like you said, you knew what was going wrong with your game and you took it right to the range afterwards and worked it out. We talked about that last episode about kind of not leaving the course with it, you know, and just, you can kind of get that confidence back by just working out what was going wrong for you. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool. And yeah, it's so true. When you get away from the game, these are the little things that go. And I find that it's, a lot of it is like fundamental stuff, you know, timing, tempo, setup even. That's a big thing for me. Yeah. That if setup is something that you have to either put a lot of thought into or hit so many balls, it becomes such second nature. And I notice a lot of times if I'm doing something a little bit wrong, you know, a slice in the ball, something like that, it's just a small change in setup just because I haven't been playing. So I'm not used to it, you know, and I'm maybe setting the ball up with my driver a little bit too far back. And I'm making impact at a point that I'm not used to, and you know, and the club face is open or whatever it may be. So it's an important thing to get used to and work that out. And I've still been doing that myself. You know, I just played last week. I was away for Labor Day for a couple of days down, you know, by the Jersey Shore, and played a course. And my first, you know, I played well too. I played really well. My first couple holes though, the driver wasn't doing anything for me again. And then I worked it out and I remembered, oh, this is what I'm doing wrong, you know? And then I just got to remember that for the next time. So I have to go through that same process again. I mean, that's the big thing. One of the biggest things that I was struggling with and I lost a couple strokes to though last weekend was that deceleration, which we talked about. And I was even more kicking myself because I'm like, we just talked about this, but it just shows, it just sheds more light that it's just a common issue that I struggle with my game. Those short shots, you know, usually 40 yards and in, you know, where I'm just taking like a 52 and just kind of like a quarter swing and just kind of bumping, running it or whatever I'm doing. And then I'm just, whatever it is, maybe don't have faith in my contact or whatever. And we're going to talk about that more. We've got actually an episode coming up shortly where we're going to talk about how to put that backspin on those short chip shots, how to make that solid contact. So we're going to talk about it, but that was something that I was struggling with. One thing though, that kind of bothered me on an off topic thing is, it was a Tillinghast design. Beautiful design as far as layout. It's definitely that old school design. He designed it back in 1929. Going into the place, nothing had changed since 1929. I can tell you that right now. It just looked like it's just been there, like time stood still type of thing. But the only thing that kind of bothered me was that they let it go into real disrepair. And it was a real shame because you could still see how at one time it was a very well laid out, prestigious course. But I mean, there was at least one green. They warned you on the way out there, it was gone. It was all sand. You know, they lost the grass.
That's a shame.
And the sad part about it was, and I was kind of trying to get the backstory and figure out what was going on with it. And the sad part is that it's one of those areas with a lot of booming real estate. And I guess the owner is trying to get approval from the town to sell it to a developer. You know,
what town was it in?
Eatontown.
Okay.
And he was trying to get the approval to sell it to a developer, and I guess that wasn't happening. And he was just like, "I'm not putting any money into it, you know,
right?
Just enough to get his tee times, you know." And then that was it. And maybe, you know, I saw maybe one, two grounds guys out there. Even the, I hate to say this, even the tee boxes weren't mowed.
Yeah, that's a shame.
It was, and it's a shame to see something like that go when it's like, you know, well known, you know, designer and beautiful.
Those designs are usually tough too. Did you have some deep Jersey rough?
You did.
Lots of trees.
The toughest part were the greens were like postage stamps. They were very small, very similar to the Tillinghast design you and I played last summer in Northern Jersey.
Yep.
That's his calling card, all false fronts, you know?
Right.
But you know, one thing I liked about it is we talked about before, like that setting that very, very narrow target, very specific target. And I was finding that this was forcing me to do that, you know, because some of the greens were so small and there were certain areas and they were protected by bunkers. I was just worrying, you know, really hyper accurate with my thing, with my aim, and it really helped me. The one shot I still remember from the day, it was just a beautiful like shot. It just felt great. It was a long par three. The whole course is fairly long, 6,700 yards, which I thought was pretty good.
Yeah.
But par three, 210 from the tee, very small little false front protected by green side bunkers on each side. And I just aimed right down the middle of those two bunkers, right for the pin, which happened to be in the middle. And I put it about just 8 feet short, dead on line of the pin.
Wow.
Two putted because, you know, I don't ever like to blame anything, but like I said, the greens were kind of gone. I really hate to say that because it's really not an excuse, but
yeah,
the ball was bouncing around. So it was kind of hard to make any putt that day, but, the shot made me feel good. And I'm just trying, like I said, we talk about remembering the good stuff from your game. So I just kind of like try to remember and think of that, you know?
Yeah. That's cool. How'd the old man play?
Oh, he did not play well.
All right.
He did not play well. So
he ate him up.
No, that was he was really frustrated too because he doesn't like that. Especially when he has a streak, he's been playing really well lately and it just ate him up that day. And I told him, here's a great segue. Equipment. It was getting in his head a little bit because he keeps his old set of clubs for like travel. And he's changed so much with his clubs. Like, you know, he's got fitted steel shaft, you know, pings. And his old set were these like off the rack. I think they're like Callaways with graphite shafts. And he's trying the whole round to adjust things for it. And I kept saying, don't adjust for these clubs. You know, just have fun. Just play. Because if you adjust too much, you're going to be kicking yourself when you go back home and you got to play with your clubs.
Yeah,
you know, they're not, they're different. You know, pitch angle on the thing. They were offset a little bit. Like, you know how those like more forgiving older Callaways are.
Right.
And I'm like, don't just swing or, you know, just have fun with it. Don't kill yourself over this equipment. And he's trying to adjust his swing to fix for that. And I'm like, no, it's going to be a mistake. So we got through the round, but
all right.
That was an interesting thing. Talking about equipment and how much that can change. If for nothing else, change your perception.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, let's talk about it, man. I'm excited.
Let's dive in. Let's start with the top of the bag. Talk to me about your driver. What do you use? You know, when did you put it in the bag and what was the reason you chose it?
Okay, so I've had a lot of success going way back when I first picked up this game. You know, Nike was the cool thing, Tiger, all that stuff. And I wanted to try the Ignite driver. So I had the Nike Ignite with the slingshots way back then, the slingshot iron. So I stuck with the Nike drivers. So when the Covert came out and then the Covert 2 came out, I actually went to the PGA Superstore and they let me take it out for a couple of days. I guess you can rent clubs. They take them off the rack and, yep, you know, the ones that have been spanked around by some of the customers. You know, and actually it's funny. I took it to Liberty National. That's the day I played Liberty National. And I took the Covert out there and I was hitting the ball beautifully with it. You know, it was so beautiful. I went back and I bought it. Mm-hmm. So that was about 4 years ago. So I've had the same driver for 4 years, which I don't know if like what the average lifespan is of a driver in a bag. I mean, some people get nuts and they change them out every 2 years or so. Some people hold on to them for 10 years or longer. So, you know, I'm right in that sweet spot and, you know, it just fits my game well. But then again, here's the question. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe I'm playing the wrong driver. Maybe I can hit more draws instead of the slices. I don't know. Maybe the angle of the shaft isn't the right way it needs to be. Maybe I should go kind of work with someone at a store and see if it's the right club for me. Because I never got fitted for that one. That was just, I like the Ignite, so I'm just going to go up to the next one.
Yeah. Look, I would not make any change. If things are going right, well, you're just going to kick yourself. I would not make a change unless it was a very well thought out change. Like I said, like go to a fitting, you know, talk to them about like what, you know, how your driver's working. You just want it to work a little bit better and then see what happens. But as far as the age and the length and forever it can go, one of the coolest things that a club fitter ever told me was he said the most power you'll ever get out of your driver is on that very last drive before the drive that cracks the face. So if you're worried about the age of your driver, don't. Okay, technology aside, okay, if you have a 20-year-old driver and technology has come a long way, but
sure,
as far drivers will actually get better with time because what happens is that the thinner that face is, the more of a springing action it's going to create, right? And each time you make impact, believe it or not, you kind of just thin out that metal a little bit more. And this is the way the guy explained it to me. He said, eventually it's just going to get so thin that it's going to crack. And that could take a lot of shots before that happens. But each time it gets a little thinner, it gets a little bit better. So if you, that's something you're worried about, it's an interesting thing. So definitely think about it.
Yeah, it is.
So my driver, I actually jumped around a little bit lately. I bought a driver maybe 5 years ago when I first started getting back into the game. I just bought something off of value type of thing. I think I was got it on Divot.com. I saw a great one-day deal, and I grabbed this Nike driver. And I actually, it was a great deal. I play it well. And I had that in the bag for a while. Until recently, I got my a chance to review a Grenade driver. Grenade, if you haven't heard of them, it's a small company based out of Vermont. Very interesting story. I think they used that. There's the local college there that they teamed up with the engineering department to help design it. Really cool, small local American company. Just make really good, solid, well thought out equipment. And I got the driver, and I had it in my bag for all of pretty much the last year. And I hit it when I hit it well. I hit it far. I'll give him that. I mean, the thing bombs. And that's why I kind of hung on to it. But the problem was, is that right now, like I said, with my back issues, I'm not playing as much as I want to be. And I started to get to a point where I'm like, all right, let's be honest with ourselves. And I think that's the hard part with equipment, is being honest with yourself sometime. We're always chasing after distance. But there does become this point where it's like, okay, how much forgiveness do I need?
Right.
I think sometimes it's this mindset that if you go for forgiveness, you're kind of giving up, or you're kind of telling yourself that I'm not that good of a golfer, that I require forgiveness, you know, but the truth is we can't all play, you know, forged blade irons, you know, we can't all do that type of thing. If your game gets to that point, great. But if not, sometimes you just got to be truthful with yourself. And where I called into question is when I was playing Bethpage Black there too, I had the opportunity to play with a guy who was a club fitter. He's a scratch golfer. He's a pro. And he showed me the face of it. And he's like, look, this is a incredibly well-engineered driver. He goes, but if I'll be honest with you, this is really made for almost a zero handicap. And I know the maker of the club may argue with that point. And he may have some points with that too. He may say it's forgiving. And I found sometimes it to be. But he kind of showed the way it was designed to hit right in the middle of that club face. And if you don't, you're going to be in a little bit of trouble. Then he showed me some of the more forgiving clubs, like the Cobra and stuff like that. And he said, and the TaylorMade, and how it dipped out a little bit further and was made a little bit more for a amateur golfer. And I kind of like was thinking about that. And I pulled my old Nike out of the garage and I put the club faces next to each other. And I saw that. It's like, yeah, the club face does get a little wider, more towards the toe. Mm-hmm. Which is where a lot of amateurs hit, you know, and whatever. So I pulled it out. I played with it. I lost some yardage, but I hit more fairways. And I started thinking to myself, listen, what would you rather? If I could tell you right now, you can either hit three more fairways in a round or hit the ball 10 yards further when you make good contact. What do you want? I'll give up those 10 yards all day. I can make that up with my irons and whatever I need to do.
Sure.
So I'm just being realistic with myself. I know right now my game is not at the level of where I want it to be because I'm working through not playing for so many months. So I'm saying, you know, I can switch back and forth, you know, at some point when my game gets better, I can switch back to the Grenade. But for now, I need a more forgiving club. I worked it in and I'm happy I made the change.
Yeah, that's interesting. You talk about the toe. I've never looked at that. So that some drivers are more forgiving, I guess, in Absolutely. A way. I know you have the bigger face ones, and everyone thinks, oh, a bigger sweet spot means less misses, but you're talking all the way down about the toe.
Yeah, what I'm talking about is when you look at the face, instead of it being very, very symmetrical around the sweet spot, because knowing that that's where, you know, the pros are going to hit it right in that middle. This one, it kind of skews some of the weight a little further out towards the toe.
Got just it. That's the Nike.
The club face. So it just allows you to miss a little bit further out because they know that's where a lot of amateurs miss. So that was an interesting one. The other thing that's very interesting, and I was kind of pulling them out and measuring them up and stuff like that. A recent article we had on Golficity, by Sam Adams, really shed some light on the length of the drivers. Did you get a chance to read that?
No, I did not.
So he's talking about how what he calls driver length creep might be the reason why you can't hit your drivers. And he said for years and years, the standard length driver was 43.5 inches. He said today, now, The average driver is 45 and a half inches long. And he said, if you're one of those guys who hits your three wood really, you know, well, think about it. The three wood is probably 43 and a half inches. He said, that's kind of like that sweet spot. That's where it really should be. And what he said was, when they show you these numbers, you see these commercials flash on the screen that this year's model is 5 yards longer than ever than any other club and whatever. What he says is that these club manufacturers, in order to kind of sneak in more distance, they're just kind of adding a little bit more and a little bit more to that shaft. And the testers that they use, those machines, they don't miss the sweet spot. Those machines are not designed to have it where you're just hitting a couple of errant shots like us.
Right.
It hits in the sweet spot every time, 5 more yards, write it down, put the commercial together, everybody's happy, right? Mm-hmm. Except for when you go to hit it and you start to realize, sure, if I make contact, everything's great, but when I don't, I'm in trouble. Sure. Think about this. Think about the biggest hitters on tour. Bubba Watson, you know? He uses that pink G20 driver. It's 44 and a half inches. Wow. So even Bubba is playing that.
Yeah.
Most of his career, Tiger Woods played a 43 and a half inch driver. So it shows you something. It tells you something about the best players in the world. These are the clubs they're using. And then we're standing out there with a 45 and a half inch driver, you know, in our hands. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So really cool, really interesting. And this is something that Sam suggested. Here's a way to test this for anybody out there who is not sure if that little bit shorter shaft length might help. Completely free way to try it out. All you got to do, choke down 2 inches.
Choke down, right?
Choke down 2 inches. It's a little bit of an more awkward feel. But he said the majority of, and Sam is a teaching pro too. He said the majority of the amateurs who come to him actually are holding the club a little bit too close to the end anyway. But he said just do that and then just see how much more control you have. If you have a lot more control, then maybe talk to a fitter about swapping that shaft out, finding out the length of the shaft, and maybe cutting it down if you need to. So I thought that was a really interesting thing.
Yeah, I shortened mine on the Covert. You know, I shorten it by an inch because you know how well I like those little hybrids, and they're small, they're tiny.
Yeah.
You know, I have tiny you know, shafts on that. And you know, by the way, just to make things clear, Sam Adams is his real name. Frank and I are not raging alcoholics. We talk about Sam Adams all the time. We mentioned Sam Adams. You know, by the way, Sam is fantastic. If you haven't read his stuff, come to the site and check it out. He's awesome at the content he puts out. But you know, I shorten the shaft on the Cobra just to kind of mimic that short shaft on the hybrid, and it really did help. It really did a lot. But I wanted to go lower, and the guy at the store is like, "No, you don't." He's like, "This is where I'm going to stop you." I'm like, "Okay, I don't know anything."
No, and when you get to a certain amount, you're going to end up standing too close to the ball, and it's going to change the angle of attack with the club head. So there is a range. You got to, you know, whatever. But it's something to talk to a club fitter about. All right, Mike, let's just go right down the line real quick, talking about the next thing you had mentioned, hybrids. So
yeah,
hybrid, okay. You know, the long iron type of things, you know, three, whatever it may be. What do you use there? Do you use all hybrids as a mix of that and long irons? What's your preference?
Okay, here's the funny thing, because my golf bag is like the spice rack on your kitchen counter. There's 30 different spices, but we only use like basil and oregano, right? Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's kind of how I feel with it. You know, I mean, does anyone else feel like they use 8 of their 14 clubs?
Yeah.
Because I rarely use my 4-5 irons or my 2 hybrid. So I have the 2 hybrid Nike Covert, which is like when I really get it, which is 1 out of 100 because I never practice it. When I do get it, it's a 250-yard club. It replaces my 3-wood when I really get it. It's very pretty when I get it. And it's kind of – it's like hitting almost the same distance of my driver minus, you know, maybe 20 yards or so, but from the fairway. But I never use it because I have no confidence in it, going back to that.
Right.
Then I have the 3 and 4 hybrid, which is my 200 and 220 to 230 clubs, which I use religiously. I use them all the time. Sometimes off the tee when I'm not feeling the driver that day. And then just for the sake of time, Frank, I'll just tell you the irons I play now, which I got fitted for recently was the TaylorMade 2.0 burners. Actually, I shouldn't say recently. I've had these irons for about, I think, 3 seasons now. So I've been playing well with them. I never felt the need to change. I've broken maybe 3 or 4 of them. I've replaced them. Instead of getting a whole new set like some people do, they blame it on the clubs and they get something new. I've gone back to TaylorMade and gotten them replaced. You know, I mean, as long as you got the head, they can replace a shaft. So I've stuck with those. So bottom line, I am only playing about 8 clubs in my bag, but that's just my golf game.
Right. And it always tends to be that if there are clubs that are neglected, it's usually those higher ones. You know what I mean? And that's where it really comes in. If you really find that that's what's happening to you, you can ditch the 3-wood or 5-wood and add in another wedge. I see a lot of guys do that, you know, if you want one more variance in degrees. But I'm a very similar way, Mike. I don't like hybrids. That's just not my thing. But I see the merits of them. I feel like, yes, they can get the ball up and you can get a nice flight path pretty easily with them. But for me, I just kind of feel like I like a little bit more of control that I get from an iron, but it's totally a preference thing. This is not something I'm going to try to steer somebody one way or the other. We talked extensively in previous episodes. So definitely, if you didn't get a chance to check that out, go back. We talked about hybrids versus long irons. We did a whole episode on it, just breaking that down. But very similarly, Mike, my 3-wood and my 5-wood. Okay. So I play a Ping G25 3-wood, which just matches with my irons. I play the Ping, G25 irons. Mm-hmm. The oldest club in my bag by far is my 5-wood. It's an old bubble burner, you know, probably 25 years old. And you know what? The only real reason I haven't replaced it is because I don't hit it enough to bother with laying out the money, you know?
Of course.
Here's the situation. There's so few situations where I use it. Even like we talked about 2-3 episodes ago, we talked about the par fives. You know, I play par fives a lot more conservatively now. You know, we're talking about the 3 and the 5-wood are clubs that I'm trying to hit. You know, my range usually for those clubs is 225 to 250-ish clubs. That's what they are for me. And I don't get a lot of opportunities to hit that. You know, there's very few par threes that I play that are shorter than 210. And honestly, on a par 3, I'd much rather hit my 3 or 4 iron into that green. Most times on a par 5, unless it's so incredibly long, I rather the consistency. I take 20, 30 yards off. I put the 3-wood back in the bag. I pull the 3-iron out or the 4-iron. And I just, especially if I can't reach the green anyway, and I just, you know, lose a couple yards distance and I'm a little bit more accurate. And part of the reason why I'm more accurate with the irons is I hit them more. I'm more used to it. It would take some real practice sessions with the other clubs. But if I use either one of them once around, you know, that's probably the average to a lot. But that said, I recently did, you know, maybe 2 years ago, got fitted for the Ping irons. If you're a regular listener to the show, you hear me talk about this all the time. It's something that I can't promote enough. Unless you're a very beginner, this is your first or second season, then I say just get whatever you can afford, get something off the rack, just start swinging. But if you start to get serious about the game, especially nowadays, it doesn't really cost anything to get fitted. Most of these, you know, club manufacturers, they do free fittings. That I got a lot out of because I feel like the clubs are made for me, you know, more as far as they measure you, they measure your stance, and it's fit. Don't forget, I mean, we're buying clubs that are standard lengths and the pitch of the actual club face when it lays on the ground is the same, but we're all different heights, you know, and we're all standing with our arms in different positions. So it gets to a point where don't adjust for the clubs, let the clubs adjust to you sort of thing. But I love my 3-iron, 4-iron, 5-iron, hit them all well. So that's where I am for those longer things. The rest of them, it's all worked in. I use them all. I feel a lot of confidence in them. I use 3-iron down to pitching wedge. But then, Mike, let's talk about this. I feel like that's kind of the common area. But then where it starts to get a little bit, you know, variant depending on the golfer is the wedges in. So what do your wedges look like?
So 52, which was part of the TaylorMade set as the A wedge gap. Yep. And then I have a Hopkins custom 56 degree, which I got customly built with the KBS shafts. And, you know, I really did it up nicely.
Yep.
And I actually, a long time ago, I won a 60 degree Callaway wedge. So my bouillabaisse of wedges in my bag, you know, from 3 different, you know, manufacturers. But I rarely ever use the 60. I'm so confident and comfortable with the 56. I can play it as a 60. I can back off it if I need to, you know, to make it a 100-yard shot versus 120. I just have the ability to do that. And I'm in the greenside bunkers. I'm with it. 100 yards out, I'm with it. So that's just my go-to club. And that's it. I mean, I really never use that 60 degree, and the gap wedge I do use because I do find myself sitting about 130 out, and you know, that's the perfect ideal club for it.
Well, let me ask you this question, because this is the biggest thing that goes into, and we talked about this in a previous episode too. So again, if we're not diving too deep into anything, and for the sake of time here, it's because of the fact that anything here we have covered before. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to that, go back and talk, you know, listen to that episode. But is there, Mike, right now, I mean, we talk about the reason for these wedges, they call them gap wedges for a reason, they fill in the gaps. Do you feel like there's a gap anywhere, a distance gap between your clubs that you can't hit right now without having to alter your swings or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, and we talked about it on the deceleration episode last week. I believe that was last week.
Yeah.
The 90 and in. 90 to 40.
Well, since you're not going to carry a 65 degree wedge, 90 and in is always going to be less than a full shot. But above that, do you feel like some guys will say, well, I hit my pitching wedge 125.
Gotcha.
And I hit my gap wedge, you know, 100. So between 125 and 100, I'm kind of stuck. Do you feel like that at all?
Yeah, I do. I mean, 115 is kind of a question mark number. I find myself there a lot. I was there a lot today. You know, yeah. I know that gap wedge can get, you know, if struck clean, hit the ball before the ground, it's 125 to potentially 130. You know, I can really get a hold of that. And then that 56 degree, I could probably get it up to about 110 to one, you know, maybe 115. So, you know, maybe the 115 to 125, 120 area, that's just like a question mark,
yeah,
you know, for me.
So that is the way you kind of back end into calculating what wedges to have out there.
Right.
You know, and that's where I'm at right now, where I'm actually thinking about making a change and just ditching that 5-wood altogether, because I can tell you right now, I come into a lot more situations in that. I would say from 125 down to 100 range that are not addressed. You know, and for my wedge situation, I have my pitching wedge that came with the set, which I don't know off the top of my head how many degrees that is. But I hit that. I can tell you right now, it's a 125 club on the number. You know, if I do a full swing, it's 125 almost every time. Beyond that, I have that Majora 52 degree wedge, which is just a thing of beauty. I love that wedge, but it's 52, right? So a full swing, I really would have to work to stretch that thing out to 105. So I kind of have a gap there to fill. Right. And then below that, a full swing with the 60 is my next club. The 60 is about a 70 yard, because that thing just pops right up in the air.
Okay.
So again, I have some variance there, and I'm slowly debating, do I work, you know, a 56 in between them? Do I work a 50 in, you know, to cover the other side and just lose the other thing? But I am kind of teetering on it. I've been in the same way as you have, what you're saying with the 60 tends to be more frustrating than anything else.
Right.
But I do like to use it for those like buried sand shots. And I think one area where you're going to find you're going to use it more once we get a chance to talk about it, because I've been doing the prep work for an upcoming episode we're going to do on how to put backspin on your chip shots.
Okay.
And one thing that we'll talk about is a great way to do that is to use some more loft, because spin, you know, loft is spin. So, interesting. I don't chip with my 60. I just don't, but I also, when we talk about this, it's a different chipping motion. So don't toss it out of the bag until we've had that episode. I'm looking forward to that.
Okay. Okay.
And then let's wrap it up. What putter?
I won this at another outing. I'm pretty good at winning things at outings, just not the outing itself. But I got the, just recently, that new TaylorMade Ghost Tour black putter. It's beautiful. I mean, I didn't want to take it out of the package, but it's been such a great addition to my game. I've really shaved a lot of strokes. I've had much more feel with my putts, a lot more lag putts. I'm just stroking the ball a lot better with this. I mean, it's not as heavy as my previous putter. So it goes to show you how important the right putter is.
Generally speaking, are you more of like a mallet or a blade guy?
This is a blade one, and that's what I've always played.
Yeah, me too. I'm the same boat. I understand like the mallet ones, it can kind of help with alignment and things like that. And some of those, they get so big, it's crazy. But that, again, I'm not going to push people one way or the other. It's definitely a preference thing. You got to see what you feel confidence in, because on the green, it's all about that confidence. But same with me, blade. I actually use a Scotty Cameron that my father, you know, passed down to me. It's not fitted to me. If I get to a point, I might do that, but I hit it way too well. It's really nicely balanced. I hit it way too well to tweak it. I just like it, and I'm very happy with it. Yeah, I'm just not going to mess with that. One thing that I did find out, though, from that same club fitter who talked to me about my driver, I didn't realize this. He said with Scotty Cameron, you can, I guess there's a fee involved, but you know, you can always send that into them, especially your older ones. They'll breathe some new life into them. They'll like, they can regrind the face. They can, he said they can even add and stamp in any logo or anything you want. So I've been kind of like debating, do I get the Golficity logo put on there?
Yeah, it's, I got it on my wedge.
So yeah, you got to do it, right? Mm-hmm. So just something to think about.
That's pretty cool. I just wanted to, throw in the accessories. I don't know if you're done with the putters. I want to talk about accessories.
Let's do it.
Because the one thing that I've changed is the Leupold rangefinder. I got one sent to me personally to do a review for the site from the company. Awesome company. You know, they specialize in hunting gear. So when you talk about scopes and rangefinders, I mean, that's what you want to go to. So that's been a great addition this season. Kind of ditched the watch. I mean, I'm frank, to be honest, I hated having to charge it. And I love the convenience on your wrist. Mm-hmm. But like, I had to charge it. When I didn't charge it, it died after the third hole and, you know, this, that, and the other. So this, I got the tiny little rangefinder in my back pocket all day, precise precision. And that's been the greatest accessory in my bag. And I didn't want to skip over balls or anything, but I wanted to jump right to that because that's been the most exciting.
Well, you know what? I think that's going to be in my future too, is some sort of rangefinder, because I haven't used one. Usually I'm playing with somebody who has one, but what I really have liked is the Arcos. And I find that their app is hyper accurate.
Sure.
And I really like that you can drag around the screen, like where distances to different things. I was using that extensively on that course that I played last week because I wasn't used to the course. The only thing I don't like about it with the Arcos system that's bothering me, and again, love it, love the system, and big fans of what they do, but the little sensors that go on at the end of the clubs,
they fall off, don't they?
Yeah, they're starting to fall. And I honestly, I lost one. And I'm like, what do I do? I'm like picking around Amazon and stuff, and I'm like, can I buy just one? Just put it in the set. And I haven't been able to find just one. And now I feel like, what's the point almost? Because now I don't like to be on my phone too much when I'm playing. Now I got to go in. The whole point of the Arcos is that you don't have to. It tracks everything for you. And I love that about it. But when one's missing, you got to go in, manually log the shot. So that's the one thing that if they sold them individually, I think everything would be great. I'd pick up a couple, you know, when I lose them, and I'd be happy. But anyway,
maybe they will.
Maybe they will. I don't want to go too long tonight, so let's just talk real quick about golf balls. What do you have a preference? Do you feel like you just play anything you find in the woods, or do you have a specific go-to?
You know what? Honestly, I tried switching to a softer ball. For some reason, I was pulling the ball more. Maybe my swing speed wasn't appropriate for it. I kind of feel like I needed a heavier ball, and it just fit my game more. So I went back to those. I've been playing those zero friction balls, and partly because I get them for free through work. Mm-hmm. They're kind of like gifts to me from vendors, and I love it. Don't get me wrong. I mean, a lot of guys spoil me with golf gear, and I get the Pro V1s even sent my way, which is great. So my answer to this is anything that's sent my way, it probably has a logo on it of the company of the guy that's given it to me, but hey, whatever, you know, I kind of just go with what I get.
Yeah. And look, so many people, like, as soon as they see they get a Pro V, they're like, oh, it's the best ball, so it's the best thing for me.
Yeah, but maybe not for you.
Right? No, yeah, we talked about this before. Like, those, lots of things, to a certain extent, it's designed for the pros. It's designed for a certain amount of spin. And you may just think, oh, spin is good, but that's not necessarily true if you don't know what to do with it. We talked about this before in a previous episode about picking the right golf ball to fit your game. Too much spin can be a bad thing if you're not applying it correctly. Mike, what I'm just so happy I found is I love the Callaway Chrome Soft.
Yep.
I told you where I looked for in my game. Again, I'm always looking for more feel than I am for other things. I'm not the type of guy who's just searching for the distance, because I find I can score better with feel over distance. And I actually end up with surprisingly still get a lot of distance out of these, because of the fact that I don't have the swing speed the pros do. You know, so I can't even take full advantage of the compression that they're using on those. Don't forget that. I mean, the ball's not going to travel as far for everybody. It all depends on that swing speed. So what I find is a softer compression ball, I'm able to compress better, and it's actually flying further. And also, I just love the feel. I'm going to always take a ball that I feels better from 100 yards and in than anything else. That soft feel on the putter face, that soft feel around the greens is what I love about it. And I don't feel like I'm giving up much. So huge fan of it. Also, you end up saving like $20 a dozen over the Pro V1. So it's a win-win.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And you know what? Something I want to buy this offseason, and one of our writers, Brian McLean, just did a review on it. I believe it's what was the name of that device, Frank? It measures your distance.
That he did a rangefinder as well.
No, it measures your distance, the carry, the swing speed.
Oh yes, yes. It's like a Trackman, but like an affordable Trackman.
It's like an affordable Trackman. Yes. That's what I want to get, because I really need to put this equipment through the ringer. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I really need to know these distances. And I think that's where my game is kind of hurting. So I think that's something I might add to the collection this offseason. And maybe just whether it's, you know, go in the garage or something and hit it at on a net, you know, using the balls that I use on the course so I can get the true number. I don't know how much trust I put into them. I never used one before, but, you know, yeah, something I consider.
That's the Swing Caddy, the Voice Caddy SC200,
yes,
if anybody's wondering. So it's a little launch monitor.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, those are really excellent for practice. So, all right, we're running really long, so I want to kind of wrap things up. That's it. You know, like I said, it's nothing too crazy. I'm not saying that there's anything in either one of our bags that I want people to emulate. What I want people to do is anything, just learn from the thought process. That's what's kind of taken us a while. It's not just going out and picking whatever clubs you think are going to work. Try to find the ones that do work and just do that process of elimination and just kind of see what works for you and what gives you the most confidence. And let us know what it is. You know, like I talked about in the Facebook group, post it there. And real quick before we wrap things up, if you haven't had a chance to do so yet, make sure you get into our big giveaway contest that we're running right now. We're going to be running that for just 2 more weeks and announcing our winner in the last week of September. You can check that out by going to golfacity.com/giveaway. Very quick, easy, 3-step process. Take you no longer than 2 minutes to get entered. It's free. And you have a chance to win our grand prize is a $300 value. And we're also going to have 4 runners up who all win a $20 Amazon gift card. So it's a great way for you to help us grow the show and that we can give back by, you know, giving some of these products away, and it's going to be exciting. So definitely check that out. All right, Mike, do you have anything else before we wrap it up?
No, man, that's it. I'm playing in my first ever member guest on Friday. Of course, I'm the guest since I'm not a member anywhere. Yep. So I'm looking forward to a fun day out on the course and hopefully a trophy.
Yeah, that's awesome. Should get good weather, so good luck with that.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, that's everything we have. We'll see everybody again next week.